The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. From the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, hoarseness, finding your voice again. Your voice sounds terrible, whether it's from a cold or a session of loud cheering for your favorite sports team. You've likely experienced hoarseness. While hoarseness is usually temporary, it can be persistent. Getting to the root of the issue can help you regain your voice. Behind the voice. Your voice is formed when air from your lungs is pushed out through the vocal cords, also called vocal folds, in your voice box or the larynx. The vocal cords are two folds of tissue that cover muscle within a cartilage framework. As air passes over the vocal cords, they vibrate, allowing sounds to fluctuate, which allows you to speak. Swelling and inflammation of the vocal cords, or laryngitis, is a common cause of hoarseness. Fortunately, most laryngitis is acute, meaning it comes on quickly and clears up in a few days to weeks. Laryngitis is most often associated with a viral respiratory infection or extended periods of talking or singing. In these cases, simple remedies that may help speed healing include drinking plenty of liquids, using throat lozenges, and resting your voice. When to see your doctor. If your hoarseness persists longer than 2 to 4 weeks and you haven't had a cold or another condition to explain it, see your doctor for an evaluation. Also, see a doctor immediately if you have other worrisome signs and symptoms, including a lump in your neck, difficulty breathing, or coughing up blood. These can indicate a serious underlying problem. Your doctor will likely begin the exam by reviewing your medical history, symptoms, and any potentially triggering factors. The quality of your voice also may be evaluated. For example, your voice may sound breathy or weak, or have a tremor quality that may offer clues to the source of the medical problem. Your doctor may perform a visual examination of your vocal cord using a small camera attached to a thin, flexible tube. In some cases, tests used to measure voice irregularities, airflow, and other characteristics can help reach a diagnosis. Causes and solutions. Management of the hoarseness depends on the underlying cause. First, inflammation and irritation. When laryngitis lasts longer than a few weeks, it's considered chronic. This may be due to allergies, other irritants, ongoing vocal strain, or reflux. Certain medications, such as angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, or ACE inhibitors, taken for blood pressure control, bisphosphonates for osteoporosis, and inhaled corticosteroids for asthma or bronchitis, also can impact your voice. Hoarseness due to chronic laryngitis is typically improved by eliminating the irritant. This may mean not smoking, resting your voice, and treating any allergies or reflux. If medications seem to be the culprit, ask your doctor for ways to minimize this side effect. Gargling and rinsing your mouth, drinking adequate water, and using a spacer with an inhaler may help. Next, vocal cord lesions. Hoarseness can be caused by non-cancerous growths along the vocal folds. These include small vocal cord swellings or polyps and callus-like patches or nodules. Often these are due to overuse of your voice, but smoking and reflux often are contributing factors. Lesions often heal with elimination of any irritants and voice therapy. Surgery may be needed to remove the persistent lesions. Third, aging. Vocal cords can naturally lose some tension and fullness as you age, often resulting in your voice sounding breathy or weak. Voice therapy is a common treatment, but if these changes greatly impair your ability to communicate, your doctor may recommend a surgical procedure in which an injection is used to add bulk and fullness to your vocal cords. 4. Vocal cord spasm. In some people, the muscles inside the vocal cords experience sudden, involuntary spasms, spasmodic dysphonia, that interfere with the coordinated vibration that allows speech. The most common treatment is Botox, injections that temporarily paralyze the affected muscles. 5, complications of other conditions. Hoarseness and voice changes are common in conditions that affect areas of the brain that control muscles in the throat or larynx, including Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and stroke. Treatment depends on the underlying condition, but working with a speech-language pathologist is often the first line of management. And then finally, cancer. Prolonged hoarseness may be a warning sign of cancer of the larynx. It's very important to have any hoarseness that lasts longer than a few weeks evaluated. Second opinion. Question. After I had hip replacement surgery 10 years ago, I was told to take an antibiotic before any dental procedure. Do I still need to do so? Answer. Possibly not. It was previously recommended that all people who'd had joint replacement surgery take antibiotics before dental procedures to prevent infection. This recommendation, known as prophylactic antibiotics, was a broad recommendation that's no longer in place. In fact, the American Dental Association released guidelines in 2015 stating that, for most people, prophylactic antibiotics should not be recommended before dental procedures to prevent prosthetic joint infection. For most people, the risks of taking prophylactic antibiotics, including infection, allergies, and the development of antibiotic resistance, may outweigh the benefits. There are some caveats to that recommendation. In particular, people who are immunosuppressed, have uncontrolled diabetes, or have a history of infection after joint replacement should take antibiotics before dental procedures. However, discuss this with your orthopedic surgeon or primary care doctor who can help you weigh the risks and benefits. While joint replacement may no longer be a reason to recommend antibiotics before dental work, there are other circumstances in which antibiotics may still be advised. If you're considered at high risk of infection in the inner lining of your heart chambers and valves, such as infective endocarditis, your cardiologist may prescribe an antibiotic before dental work. This includes people with prosthetic heart valves or a history of infective endocarditis, as well as people with certain congenital heart diseases. However, the current guidelines for this use also apply to fewer people than in the past and may be worth revisiting with your doctor. If prophylactic antibiotics are recommended, your doctor can provide a dosing regimen appropriate for you. Next question. I take the drug prednisone to control rheumatoid arthritis. Recently, a friend told me that I should be concerned about side effects from the long-term steroid use. Is she right? Answer, it's true that corticosteroids such as prednisone can cause a range of side effects, but they may also relieve the inflammation and pain, as well as prevent or control tissue damage of many different diseases and conditions, including severe allergies, autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, and other inflammatory conditions. Often the side effects of corticosteroids depend on the dose and duration of the medication, as well as the form you receive it in. Side effects from oral corticosteroid use may include elevated pressure in the eyes or glaucoma, fluid retention causing swelling in your lower legs, increased blood pressure, increased blood sugar, which can worsen or even trigger diabetes, changes in mood, memory, behavior, sleep, or other psychological effects, weight gain. Long term, you may experience cataracts, increased risk of infections, increased cholesterol, osteoporosis and fractures, suppressed adrenal gland hormone production, and thin skin, bruising, and slower wound healing. It's important for you and your doctor to watch for side effects from corticosteroids. Depending on the dose and the anticipated duration of corticosteroid use, your doctor may prescribe medications to help prevent certain side effects and order tests to monitor for others. If side effects become an issue, your doctor or pharmacist can recommend ways to minimize them. Don't abruptly stop using a long-term steroid. Your doctor or pharmacist can advise you on the safe way to taper your steroid use if it's recommended. Breast cancer screening, answering questions. It's time for your mammogram to screen for breast cancer. You've been doing this for so many years that it's become your annual routine. But does it need to be? Does it need to be? Could you get by with a mammogram about every 2 years? Are you old enough to stop having them? Breast cancer is the second most common cause of cancer-related death in women in the United States. Most women recognize the importance. Excuse me. Most women recognize the importance of screening to catch breast cancer in its earliest stages, when treatment is often simpler and more effective. However, questions such as these and many others often cloud the process. Mayo Clinic breast cancer experts answer some common questions. First question, should I examine my own breasts? The answer, this is an area of debate, but Mayo experts feel that breast awareness is important. If new breast changes are noted, seek prompt evaluation by your doctor. Changes may include a new or changing lump, new or unusual breast pain, skin changes such as dimpling or retraction on the breast surface, or a change in skin texture, especially if it resembles the texture of an orange peel, swelling, firmness, redness, soreness, or warmth in the breast, nipple changes such as development of a rash or discharge, or new retraction of the nipple into the breast. Question, at what age should women begin having screening mammograms? Answer, for women at average risk, Mayo recommends an annual mammogram or 3D mammogram beginning at age 40. Individualized changes can be made based on a discussion with your doctor. This may include being screened annually or once every 2 years. Question, I've been told I have dense breast tissue. What does this mean? Answer, dense breast tissue refers to the appearance of the breast on routine mammograms. Women with a higher proportion of dense breast tissue compared with fatty tissue have a higher risk of breast cancer. In addition, dense breast tissue can decrease accuracy of screening imaging studies. Dense breast tissue is very common in younger women. Due to a number of factors, breast tissues can change over time, and dense breast tissue declines in older women. Still, about one-third of postmenopausal women are classified as having dense breasts. In terms of breast cancer screening, dense breast tissue and tumors both appear white or on a traditional mammogram. Therefore, it's harder to spot a small tumor, and some early cancers may go undetected. In addition, there's increased risk that dense tissue will be mistaken for a tumor, a false positive that often leads to additional testing that's ultimately unnecessary. Regardless of breast density, traditional mammography is the standard screening test for women with average risk of breast cancer. However, for average risk women with dense breast tissue, whole breast ultrasound imaging may be an option. In addition, newer screening tests may be an option, including 3D mammography or breast tomosynthesis. This is similar to standard mammography, except it takes many more images to create a clearer 3D view of breast tissue. The main advantage of 3D mammography is that it reduces the need to return for additional mammograms or extra visits or extra views. Molecular breast imaging, or MBI. This special method developed at the Mayo Clinic uses a radioactive tracer that's injected in a vein in your arm. Images of the breast are taken using a special MBI machine. Studies have found that MBI is more likely than a mammogram to find cancerous tumors in dense breasts. It's important to know that there are pros and cons to both of these additional screening tests, including added cost, potentially more mammograms, or other imaging tests and biopsies. Question, if I get called back for additional testing after a mammogram, does this mean I have cancer? Answer, no. In fact, 95% of the time, when additional testing is done, there's no cancer present. Still, it's hard to escape the sense of anxiety if you're one of the roughly 10% of women who get a callback for additional testing after a mammogram. Additional testing is often done because the first images don't show the entire breast, or there's a small finding on the exam that requires clarification to make sure that there's not a problem. When additional testing determines no cancer, the original results are considered a false positive, and you can return to regular screening. Question. I have a family history of breast cancer. Is a mammogram enough? Answer. This is an important discussion to have with your doctor. As a part of an overall risk assessment, a number of screening risk calculators can help classify your risk level based on a number of factors, including family history. Depending on your risk level, you and your doctor may decide that other screening tests, such as magnetic resonance imaging or an MRI, are needed in addition to mammograms. If you know that you carry one of the breast cancer genes, and the two are BRCA1 or BRCA2, you have a first-degree relative, mother, sister, or child, who carries one of these genes, you have had a chest radiation treatment, or you have a history of cancer yourself, it is recommended that you have additional screening with MRI in addition to mammography. Finally, the question, when can I stop having breast cancer screening tests? Answer, there's no specific age cutoff for stopping mammography. Rather, it's recommended to keep having mammograms as long as your life expectancy is at least 10 more years. Restless legs syndrome. Unwanted urge to move. You're winding down for the night and you feel it yet again. That uncomfortable, crawling, deep seated sensation in your legs and a gnawing, irresistible urge to move them. Sensations such as these may be caused by restless legs syndrome or RLS, also called Willis-Ekbom disease. The sensations of RLS can range from mildly annoying to incapacitating, and a key secondary symptom is difficulty getting good sleep. Combined, these can have a damaging effect on energy, vitality, thinking, and mood. That restless feeling. Diagnosing RLS is based on identifying telltale symptoms. These include an urge to move the legs along with an uncomfortable sensation in the thighs, calves, or feet, or occasionally the arms that may be described as creeping, jittery, tingling, electric, burning, or aching. Sometimes the urge to move the legs can occur without these sensations. Sensations that begin or worsen during rest or inactivity, such as lying down or sitting, and worsen in the evening or at night. And sensations that are relieved by movement, such as walking or stretching, as long as the activity continues. It's common for people with RLS to have difficulty sleeping or to feel that sleep isn't restorative. About 80% of those with RLS also have periodic limb movements of sleep, PLMS. This consists of nighttime leg jerking or kicking while asleep that can disturb sleep quality and often without you knowing it. If you have milder RLS symptoms that occur intermittently and aren't impacting your life much, you may be able to claim to calm the sensation by massaging your legs, stretching leg muscles, walking, or taking a warm bath. To prevent symptoms, keeping the mind occupied in the evening, such as with crossword puzzles, conversation, knitting, or other activities may help. A trial of stopping any afternoon or evening caffeine intake might be considered, as this can sometimes contribute to the problem. If symptoms aren't manageable on your own, the first step is to test for insufficient iron levels with a blood test called a serum ferritin test. Even serum ferritin measurements that are within the typical normal range may be low enough to contribute to RLS symptoms. If low, oral iron replacement with a supplement is typically recommended, although intravenous iron replacement may be considered in some cases. Another early step is having your doctor or pharmacist look at any prescription or non-prescription drugs or supplements you take to assess whether any of them might be contributing to symptoms. Drug options. For those with more troublesome symptoms that occur less than twice a week, drug options include low dose of the combination drug carbidopa, levodopa, or Sinemet. This quick-acting Parkinson's drug is taken when symptoms arise. One potential limitation with frequent and longer-term use of this drug is augmentation, in which RLS symptoms start earlier and earlier in the day over time and worsen. Lower doses and intermittent use may reduce this risk of augmentation. Another potential limitation is rebound, in which symptoms begin occurring in the morning, which happens in about 20 to 35% of those taking the drug. Next, low-potency opioid-based drugs. These can be taken intermittently as symptoms arise. Options include codeine or tramadol, which is Ultram. If symptoms require daily treatment, drug options include dopamine agonists. These include drugs also used for Parkinson's disease and include Maripex, Requip, and a skin patch, Nupro, N-E-U-P-R-O. As with carbidopa levodopa, dopamine agonists can result in augmentation, with about 40 to 70% of people developing it after 10 years of use. Risk of augmentation may be lower with the skin patch. Impulse control disorders such as compulsive gambling or shopping, binge eating, or hypersexuality are other potential side effects, occurring in about 6 to 17% of people on these drugs. Of note, people with RLS are not at increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Finally, certain calcium channel anti-seizure drugs. These include Neurontin and Lyrica. For those with long-lasting symptoms, a longer-acting version of Neurontin called Horizant, H-O-R-I-Z-A-N-T, may be preferable. Dopamine agonists and calcium channel anti-seizure drugs have comparable success rates in controlling RLS symptoms. Choosing one over the other often depends on your circumstances. In general, dopamine agonists are preferred for those with severe RLS symptoms and those who also have depression or are overweight. The anti-seizure drugs are often preferred for those who also have chronic pain, anxiety, or insomnia, or for those with previous impulse control concerns. And then finally, other options. Sometimes these drug options aren't effective. They decline in effectiveness or side effects become intolerable. In these cases, it's often worthwhile to go back to the basics and thoroughly review iron status or other factors, such as a sleeping disorder or drug, that may be hampering efforts to control symptoms. In addition, there are several options for transitioning to another drug or combining two different drugs. Confused about eating soy. This is the Harvard Health letter. Confused about eating soy. The FDA wants to pull its support of the health claim that eating soy protein may help reduce the risk of heart disease. The agency proposed the change last fall, citing evidence that questions whether there is any real benefit to heart health. If the FDA goes through with the move, then food makers will no longer be allowed to market soy products with the claim that they can help your heart. But soy won't hurt your heart, and soy does have other benefits. It's high in polyunsaturated fats, fiber, vitamins, and minerals, and low in saturated fat. Natural soy products like tofu or edamame could replace red meat and other animal sources of protein higher in saturated fat, says dietitian Kathy McManus, who's director of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. One caveat, some soy products contain estrogen-like chemicals that could have adverse effects, so stay away from soy, isoflavone supplements, and foods made with textured vegetable protein and soy protein isolate found in many protein powders and nutrition bars. Still, McManus says it's okay to eat whole soy foods like soy milk, edamame, and tofu in moderation several times a week. Exercise, still the best approach to prevent falls. Regular exercise in older adults offers powerful protection against falls. That's the conclusion of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, published recently by the Journal of the American Medical Association. Task Force members reviewed the latest evidence, about 20 studies, and said there was enough to confirm that exercising, muscle strengthening, and improving balance could help prevent falls in high-risk older Americans or older adults. Most people in the studies exercised 3 times a week. The benefit remained the same whether people performed individual routines, participated in exercise classes, or underwent physical therapy. The USPSTF also recommended that doctors offer additional measures to prevent falls depending on a person's risks, like getting an eye exam if you have poor vision. And the task force found that taking vitamin D did not prevent falls in older adults. So it is recommended against taking a supplement just for that purpose. Vitamin D is important if you have osteoporosis or vitamin D deficiency. The takeaway, falls are the leading cause of injury and injury-related death in older adults. If you're not active, try walking a little each day if your doctor says it's okay, and build toward walking at least 20 minutes a day. Higher vitamin D levels linked to lower risk of diabetes. Vitamin D is an essential vitamin. Low levels are associated with poor bone and muscle health and other chronic conditions such as heart disease and cancer. Now, a study published online has tied higher vitamin D levels to lower diabetes risk. Researchers followed 900 older adults, average age 74, for 12 years, checking their vitamin D and blood sugar levels during clinic visits, compared with people whose blood levels of vitamin D were below 30 nanograms per milliliter. People with vitamin D levels of 30 nanograms per milliliter or more had one-third the risk for developing diabetes. And people whose D levels were 50 nanograms per ml or more had one-fifth the risk. The study does not prove that taking vitamin D supplements to raise blood levels of vitamin D would reduce the risk of diabetes, although that is possible. The Institute of Medicine maintains that a blood level of 20 nanograms per ml or higher is sufficient for 97% of the population. Other authorities think that levels higher than 20 are better for health. Large studies are underway to help resolve these differences of opinion. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and be healthy.